Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the Newism podcast, where we talk to social innovators and disruptors to discover how they would shape a new, more inclusive economic system fit for the modern world. Our guest this week is Baroness Mary Gowdy, who has dedicated her career to advocating for the rights of women and promoting gender equality. She works with numerous institutions around the world to help drive peace, security, and diversity, and is a founding member of the 30% Club, which aims to bring more women onto corporate boards across the world.
Well, I'm here in London with Mary Gowdy, sitting in her home, and we're talking about the Newism, our notion that we need to create a new economic system. And so first of all, Mary, I'd like to just ask you to talk about your life and the areas of where you've kind of clearly fought for around equality, and particularly equality for women. What drove you to get into that space initially?
What drove me to get into that space initially was I was on the London Borough of Brent. I was one of the youngest councillors to be elected in the late 70s, early 80s. And the area I represented had the highest number of cot deaths, had most highest people unemployed, generations of people who never went to work. To me, it was quite unusual because I came from an Irish family where going to work was, you never missed a day. You're not allowed to miss a day off school. You weren't allowed to miss a day off anything. So, you know, the work ethic I understood. But then I started to understand with looking and talking to people why these people, not these people, but why people I represented in Roundwood Ward were as they were. And at the same time, you had people being rehoused because they were in difficult conditions. I learnt about nervous asthma caused on by mice scratching. People didn't have hot water. They still had, in some cases, toilets outside. During that period, one was able to see some of them being knocked down, refurbished. But then you realised that in a lot of cases, it was women that were going to work. It was women who were responsible. And so they were working on the night shift in McVitie's on the Park Royal Estate, and doing these other jobs, packing birthday cards at home in those awful cellophane bags, doing thousands of them, and that there was no real access to proper finance, you know, or no real access to proper work other than factory work. And to get people to get qualified even after school was difficult. And then as the years have gone on, one has realised that access to finance is really important. And not only was now, and we're seeing this change, that there was battles in some areas to get banks to open. Some of the deals with banks were, you know, in government status or in local authority planning. Are you going to open a bank on this estate or near this estate? I mean, that was basic access to finance because there was no cash machines then.
Of course.
So, and people were getting money. People were slowly having access. But if you can't access a bank, how can you start to look at accessing a mortgage? How can you start to understand about that kind of borrowing? And it was women that were always. And then as I went abroad, you learnt much more.
So what you were finding was there was a large amount of exclusion.
Oh, huge exclusion.
Inequality in the estate, but it seemed to be that the worst excluded or the most excluded were the women.
Yes, definitely the women. And but they were expected to keep everything together. And then as the years have gone on, you learnt about where women couldn't get access to finance, where you've got SMEs around the world starting. And we know that SMEs are the backbones of a number of communities, employing both men and women. And all these issues can't be solved without men and women working together. And it's not just a women's issue, it's a family issue. It's a whole issue around business. And if you don't have proper access to all sorts of finance, then you're not going to survive. And under the Obama administration, when he was chair of the G20, one of the issues that was coming up through the Sherpas of the various countries over the years was access to finance. And various instruments were put in place at that time to ensure that the banks were supposed to make access to finance. That I haven't seen. That's why microfinance has made a big difference. But it is the banks lending to the microfinance people to lend to the.
So it's still the old system.
It's still the old system.
Old system, but.
And we saw with payday loans that it was the NatWest that was lending to those. And if it wasn't for Sheila Casey and one of my peers in the House of Lords, that taking out a loan. He took a loan out and watched it mount up. And mm. Sheila had got the basis from her constituency.
Right. So we used it as an example.
These are examples. Yeah. And this is happening around the world. Yeah. We know in villages in Africa, in villages in other places. Right. So the other access to finance has come through the World Bank's instrument on mobile phones. So that at the time, we were very lucky that you had Cherie Blair and Hillary Clinton in titular senior positions. So they were able to launch and had access to, to non-profits and others to help to roll this out. I mean, they became so that women could then get money to them by onto the mobile phone.
So moving forward in our, because we've got blank bits of paper here for our new economy, a critical thing to your mind would be access to proper finance.
Proper finance.
So not exorbitant interest rates to women. That would be a key thing.
And women always repay. Yeah. If you look,
If
you look on the statistics around the world, women always repay before time usually.
Yeah.
And then can get another loan.
Yeah, that's right.
And then the money is ploughed back into the family or the business or both.
Absolutely. I think there's a real demonstration that with Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, which Mohammed Yunus does.
Yes.
But do you think...
And in other parts.
Yes. I mean, it's
Kenya now, there's quite a big microfinancing as well.
South America.
Yes.
South America.
And they need it in South America. But, it's...
Yeah. But, so would do you think then that we should, in our new system... that type of microfinance should be available to all, and we should just shut down the current banking system, and this microfinance really should be our way of life?
I think microfinance should be available to all. Mm-hmm. And I think even people who are on benefits or on pensions, and some people have small and large pensions, but because they are on pensions or because they have their income is on benefit, it's not their fault, their sick benefit or widow's benefit, even if they were widowed early or late, that they also should not be shut out. Because if you are living on a pension, and some people have got a huge pension because they've paid in or they've invested, and others because they've worked or they're various, that it's very difficult to get a loan because you're a pensioner, because it's all done by a computer and by people who've not done the reading.
Yeah.
So we have to look at overall access. Right. But one of the things that we should do, and the government is pushing just now, they said they wouldn't, but this is one of their promises that they have the right to U-turn on, is all this money that's hoarded away in offshore.
Yeah.
The offshore thing has to be taken, the offshore instruments have to be taken care of.
Yeah. So one of the problems, I think, with this current global system is that it's wealth going to wealth.
Absolutely,
so
that's why offshore
has to
go.
You've got wealth, more money goes towards it. So I think just yesterday the figures came out that 2% of the world's population own 80% of the
wealth. Absolutely, yeah.
And that's not sustainable.
Not sustainable. And they're not ploughing back. It would be sustainable. Well, I wouldn't think it. But if that was sustainable, why are they not ploughing it back?
Yeah, well, it seems
into
that what's happening.
World.
It's the system.
Yeah.
The system means that you basically, if you have the money, you're investing it, which is earning more money, and it's almost like you
but they're investing it in...
You can't help yourself.
Yes, you can't. But you can't touch what they're investing. It's that it's not necessarily being invested to, say, Britain PLC or an African village or some village here up in Scotland that's got two women running a really good business, but they need access, but the bank won't give it to them because they're women and they're in their 60s or something, and they're employing 10 people though, including say 50% men as well.
Yeah. So a crucial plank going forward then in an economic system, access to finance for women is absolutely
critical. Yes.
Because as you were saying earlier, actually if it was loans, they know how to repay it. Actually, they're better organising it. Actually, they're better working together as in a group, and better understanding the family, whatever, with a nuclear family or a wider family, doesn't matter, understanding that value and holding it together.
And we have to consider that. And banks don't understand that now. They don't want to understand, although some of those people sitting making the decisions are members of a nuclear family. They just want to keep everything to the way it was.
Yeah.
Roses round the door, and you know they want to keep to that method, and that method is not safe because they'll lend to somebody like some guy will come in, and he's got some crazy idea, but they fancy that, and he's got some backers, and he'll lose them all that money. We've seen examples of that.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, and I think it's there's plenty of demonstrations and examples
and pension funds too,
and pension funds as well, all over the world. It's been. I'm so interested in your thoughts on this because a lot of people we've been speaking to in this kind of series of talking about the kind of crisis of leadership in the world, and it seems that there's not enough women coming into leadership positions. Would you agree with that? And if so, how do we get women into leadership positions?
We have to do that. What's happening is we've got more women qualified as lawyers, architects, engineers. The STEMs are getting much better. In the motor industry, you've got some great women engineers, certainly around Austin Martin and Rolls-Royce. I've seen these engineers where they're looking at environmentally friendly sports cars. Can you believe it? You know, this is huge for Britain if these take off, you know, and for other countries. And you've got in a number of companies I deal with around the world, they've got women seem to get so far up the pipeline. I hate that word, but pipeline. And then something stops. And there's a lot more programs for returners. That's becoming, companies want people to come back because it's like restaurants or hotels. You know what you've got. It's a better value. But somehow something stops. And that's why we founded the 30% Club, to try to get 30% women on boards at the same time to try to change the pipeline. Because when you get to that position, the whole situation in the discussions and in the meetings change. And we need to get women to be chairman of the audit committee and other important committees. Because when you do that, the dynamics change, the whole way the company operates change, but the bottom line does better.
All right, that's so interesting. Tell us a little then about this 30% Club. Is this a minimum you have to have on boards?
It's a minimum we decided. My friend Helena Morrissey and myself, who's just come out, had her book published, It's a Great Time to Be a Girl, who doesn't believe that you have to lean in, but we try to change the system as we go along, which is the way I like it. When I'm looking at legislation, don't try and get new legislation. Let's look what's on the books. Let's see how we can do an amendment here, and it's this and that. You can make change without going through, you know. And Helena in her book talks about how we could make change, especially in the whole situation of women on boards. And it was with Helena many years ago, I founded the 30% Club. Yeah. And we worked out that to make this change, it's not because we didn't want quotas. We worked very hard on the Cameron government not go for quotas that the European Commission were pushing for members of the European Commission to have, but we wanted targets. So it's 30% is where the whole chemistry and everything in the board changes.
Yeah, it's so interesting what you're talking about, this kind of chemistry change and so on.
And respect as well.
And respect. So in
our... Because you've got one woman, oh, well, you know.
Yeah, but it's so interesting, these words there, because... In this new economic system or new ism that we're talking about, there's key values. So
that's
you
right.
Mentioned the word respect. So respect has to be there, doesn't it?
Respect has to be, and part of respect is better language.
Yeah.
And I always remember once speaking to somebody in Glasgow, because it was there, when I said, why haven't you got any women on your board? So he said, well, we can't swear on things. I said, well, do you swear in your board meetings?
Yeah.
Do you swear at home? Why do you have to swear in the board meeting? Language is important and respect is important. But it's up to a chairman to give the leadership to the board and to his company and to CEO to bring people on. And to respect them for what they bring. Because not everybody's a mathematician, but other people have interpersonal skills. They know about the issue. They know about where goods are made. They're willing to work with people to ensure they get the right kite mark. Yeah. So that the goods are not made by slave labour or bonded labour fished off places where nobody ever gets off the fishing boat.
It does seem so odd, doesn't it, that here we are in this kind of modern world and we're still talking about this, because it's kind of obvious. There's 50% men and women in the world. Why can't you have this kind of more equality in these positions? Because then you'll get a better representation of what the 50-50 of the world is like.
If you have a better society.
Yeah.
And it's not about religion. It's much more about culture.
Yeah.
And as a great friend of mine, Ambassador Milan Vivier, says, what are these men afraid of? when there was a particular very violent issue in Afghanistan and again in the Sudan, where women were really, and the Yazidi women. What is it that ISIS is afraid of with women? Why is it they don't like women? They're good enough clean the house and things, but they're not good enough to have any leadership role.
It's
not a religious thing. I'm on a family foundation, the Lahibri Family Foundation, which is a Muslim foundation. And I've learned huge amounts with them. And I have another friend who's Jewish who's really interested. And she says, if I was born again, I'd love to be a Muslim. Their way of life and their giving is so... And the more I've learned about that and this whole train of how they give in Ramadan, their philanthropic giving is huge.
So do you think that there's things from religion, issues from religion we could pick up in this new economy, like from the Muslim religion in terms of giving?
And in terms of... In terms of give, they give enormously. And my friend, I haven't got the book here, but my friend Baroness Wasi, who was born here, like myself, of immigrant parents. Yeah. I mean, she talks about this in her book. It's quite a heavy tone. I kept telling her she needs to write it. I mean, I like it. I love her. But I mean, her book, if she could write a piece of her book the size of Helena's book, it would be, easier to get everybody to read it. Yeah. But she spells it out there about, it's not the religion. It's about we've got to work together and give together.
So in our new economy then, in this new kind of world, giving is a very important
part
of what should be there.
Yes.
We should be, as human beings, as communities, open to giving and supporting one another.
That's right. Now, in the Jewish religion, Catholic religion, and in the Muslim religion and others, people come to their place of worship and they give. And they give food or they give carpets or they give money or... whatever. So because we are now changing in the world, and although we're all born into religion, but there should be a place not just to give, we do have food banks and so on. But that's not the best example, but we need to have a way that people don't, that it's not cash, it's about giving in different ways. We've got to be more giving.
Isn't it about an attitude of giving, of looking out and being aware of the people around you? So seeing people on the street, maybe doing something about that.
Yes, not giving to them, because
giving,
it goes on, creating an atmosphere that these people should not be on the streets.
In the first place.
We should be pushing government to ensure that there's a place to stay the night.
So, my view would be, for example, on food banks, yes, we give to food banks because people should have to eat, but at the same time, there shouldn't be any food banks.
There shouldn't be any food banks. Because and we know that.
How have we gotten to a situation where we have food banks? Isn't it absurd?
It's absurd. And when we're supposed to be paying people a proper wage, they still don't have enough. Even nurses and teachers still go to food banks and others. And this is totally wrong, because what's the price of food? And also, we have to change the food we're giving people.
Yeah.
And this big now. Likely amalgamation of Asda and Sainsbury's. People don't have real choice, and so women workers and men, because it's 80% around the world of agricultural workers are women.
Yeah.
And they'll be squeezed because they've got the problems of climate change as it is walking, walking further for water.
Yeah.
And now they'll be squeezed even more so by these conglomerates up there and they're down here.
Yeah.
So, that's not right in this world.
Yeah.
And to have one grouping owning everything is not.
So how do we change it?
Well, we have to say no to some of these, governments around the world have to come together to say people have to have choice.
Yeah. And do we have to tackle then these big global conglomerates? Are we kind of saying, globalization's there, but hey, these big entities that are kind of forcing the price down, many people would say causing poverty, they have to be broken up.
Yes, because if you think of what Walmart owns.
Yeah, massive.
We don't all know what Sainsbury's owned. And there's this big company in Australia that owns one of the big do-it-yourself companies here, which I thought was owned by some. But, there's these conglomerates that not only do they own food that we eat, they own where we buy our furniture, where I buy, we're being ruined. We're being run not just by the international, like the European Commission or the WTO or something, but we're really being run by these big companies.
Yeah. So do you think we need to be going back? Because there's this challenge always in global economy, I think, between the big and small. So have we gone too far? We need to be going backwards and to say, we actually require smaller units. Communities are very important to us. Knowing where the food comes from, supporting our local farmers, et cetera, et cetera. Is that where we should be going?
That's where we should be going. And at the moment, supporting our local farmers or supporting free trade and all of that can only be done by people who are earning really well or have good pensions coming in or make that choice not to go to do other things, so they have money to buy that sort of food or to grow their, because it's, it doesn't give choice to low-income families to be able to go to the farmer's market. It can a bit, but, you know, it's, they don't always realise it can be a bit cheaper.
Yeah.
But there is no real choice.
Yeah.
If it's either the farmer's market here on a Saturday, or you're, or if you're busy with your children, it's going late night to Tesco's or Waitrose whatever's near.
So there needs to be a change in the relationship in some way between the producer and the
buyer.
There
has to be a big change, because also it is breaking up communities around the world. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, when these big people come in, all these small places close down, like pubs and everything, because they offer terrible food in these supermarkets to eat, and so the locals close down. Then they decide this isn't making enough money. So we've seen examples here, and we've seen it in other parts of Europe and in America, where they then decide to make these into flats or whatever, or factories, and then there's nothing for anybody in the community. So the community is changing, money is changing,
mm-hmm.
and it's the banks that are giving in to all these people. So the economy has to change in some way.
Yeah, absolutely, that's the fundamental.
The
issue,
fundamental is how is the money being distributed.
Being distributed.
It's the distribution of the money.
And that's what we talk about in terms of the economy.
Yeah, because, that's right, yes.
Because, exactly right. So my view is that this system's broken.
The system is broken because ordinary people cannot get an opportunity. Look, even with high income, the banks are asking too much for people to have a mortgage. And they're deciding. They have no idea. And they want to know how much everybody spends even just going to the cinema. That's not allowed. You're feckless.
Yes, that's right. And all your data, of course, in terms of what you're doing is kind of...
Yes, if you go out to eat too often a week, that's feckless too. You should be going by the supermarket food city, you know. But that's in all these forms. You see what data they want.
So it's up to us then, as in some ways, as consumers then, to start.
To start, we have to sort of say to government, you have to check.
Yeah, but it's not easy. We were talking earlier about, you know, we live these lifestyles now where we run around, so
yes.
We actually do the kind of fast shopping and
yes.
So on and so forth, whereas actually probably we should go and seek out local suppliers and so on. But so there it's up to us as
individuals,
all of us,
everybody.
To say, okay, well, collectively then, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to be giving as well. And so how can we create that atmosphere or that culture?
We have to get both people in schools and in universities, but also we need to get the newspapers of this world, the economists and others, and people, because people listen to so much social media, which I can't keep up with it all. I mean, or those who sit under the blankets every day.
Yeah.
You know, we need to get more discussions, more TED Talks to start this off.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Skoll Talks, the other ones that are around the world, the Mishkin Institute, there's the Bruggen Institute, there's all these various...
One of the reasons I'm sitting here because there are a lot of really interesting discussions going on. There are a lot of interesting theories and a lot of action, but they're not connected.
They're not connected at all.
How do we get to be connected? How do we get people to talk together and say, hey, look, can we not agree on five things, for example, just making that up, that we might want to do and push out? Are we not overcomplicating by trying to do something? Overcomplicating them, and there's too many players.
We need to get the key players need to try to influence the treasuries in some of the more enlightened countries,
mm-hmm.
to influence the Sherpas who go to these international meetings like ASEAN, like the G19 now, the G7, the Council of Ministers of Europe, the various Nordic countries. We need to get those people saying this is what we need to do.
So you mentioned they're enlightened countries. So what would you say currently in the world is an enlightened country?
Scandinavian countries.
Because they are looking after their citizens more.
They're looking after citizens more. Citizens have longer holidays, better health service, but the argument better maternity care, better paternity care, school life's better, university's better, but the argument some people have about that is that they have smaller populations.
So, maybe that's an answer then. Are we again like becoming the big corporates? are coming too big. We're becoming these kind of global citizens. We all want to be global citizens.
We all want to be global citizens, yes.
But we want to have our own national identity
as well.
That's
right. We don't want to be the nanny, but we mustn't be the nanny state.
Yes.
We mustn't say to someone, you can't have more than two children. That would be totally wrong.
But it is interesting, though, the Scandinavian model. A lot of people will talk about
the Iceland model, too.
But one of the things that's common in all these Scandinavian countries is they do pay higher taxes.
They pay very high taxes, but they don't seem to complain too much.
Well, I wonder whether the issue is with these, that the people are willing to pay higher taxes because they trust the government. So in other words, giving them money and they trust that
they have a good quality of life from them.
Yes.
You don't hear about cuts there.
So is there an issue about in other countries then about people who are not willing to pay tax? They don't trust the governments to spend the money properly.
No, it's a thing that you shouldn't pay too much tax. And it's portrayed by people like Trump now, mm-hmm. and in this country for a time, you know, big, small men, but men and women who own big companies, but say we'll move away or we'll close down if we have to pay a higher tax, if we're going to have to pay higher benefits mm-hmm. for our workers, you know, if we're going to have to pay higher. So they've always used that sort of, we'll take our toys away mm-hmm. if you do that. Mm-hmm. But if you don't pay tax, now they're complaining in the UK, in the villages, that roads are dirty, or in some places, rubbish is only being collected twice a week. Well, if you don't pay tax, yeah. you can't have it.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have in America, you've got places where they vote for education money in areas, and they vote it down. They won't pay higher tax. So you've got badly educated people. And why do you wonder? When they're not paying, they then say, if you're not paying.
Yeah. So that's very interesting, isn't it? Because then you've got some countries there who are quite happy to pay the higher tax because they can see the benefit.
Absolutely.
In other countries, it's the complete opposite.
Because they're badly educated from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And it's how we have to change that outlook. And we have to have people stopping saying, this is too expensive. We have to be saying we should be paying more because that's where our children or our grandchildren or great-grandchildren would be like those children in those countries, and they'd be healthier too.
Yeah.
The GDP of the country would change
because
if people are born safer, because, you know, the first 100 days from conception is what matters to everybody and how we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's that first 100 days, not the first 100 date of birth, but the first 100 days.
Yeah. So in terms of looking after those,
I can give you
days,
something on that from a UN person.
Yeah. No. I mean, there's so much work the United Nations have done in the World Health Organization.
I've learned so much from them over the years.
It's fascinating.
That's why things have to change, because we wouldn't have the poverty that we have in Asia and parts of it if governments were able to invest in their people, in their health and education.
Yeah.
And that's why the money has to change.
Yeah, in terms of the government. So the issue
is the redistribution.
It's
an old-fashioned word. You have to look at a different word.
What you're saying is that actually the public sector, if you like, which is kind of much maligned these days by everybody, actually has to reassert itself.
It has to reassert itself to make the difference.
And services or those products coming from the public sector have to be paid by tax, and that should be seen as being okay. So in our new system, tax is okay.
Tax is definitely okay.
But the relationship with the taxpayer and the government has to change, and the taxpayer has to trust the government that it's going to do the best with the money that we are paying.
Because at the moment, the trust between the people around the world and government has broken. And when the trust is broken, it takes a long time to repay the trust. As we've seen in Scotland, as we've seen in other countries.
Yeah. So the kind of this, it's very important, I think, this kind of relationship between the public, tax, to government, and what government does, and where the public sector is so important in an economy going forward, in your opinion.
So what I think at the moment is the trust has been broken, by politicians, and also by third-party disendorsements who don't play in politics but take ads. Mm-hmm. Some of the extreme right,
mm-hmm.
you saw this in the referendum. Mm-hmm. We've seen this happen in the American elections. Mm-hmm. Seen it happen in the French. We've seen the Italian elections.
Yeah.
So we see that the trust is broken, and also there seems to have come because people don't understand displaced people,
yeah.
that they seem to be jealous of displaced people, although some of them yeah. have come from families who were displaced.
Yes, in the first place.
In the first place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
wherever you are in the world, yeah. you are children of displaced people.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if it's 300 years ago.
Or so how do we rebuild the trust?
We have to rebuild the trust because we've got to change the messaging.
Yeah, and that comes back to the leadership again?
Yes.
Or is politics broken as well?
Some forms of politics are broken because politicians have broken it
right.
by breaking the trust, getting themselves into trouble, yeah. of all sorts of trouble, you yeah. know, not just money, sex, violence, you know, all sorts of reasons, going on tripettes, you know yeah. what I mean?
So there's respect has gone.
So respect has gone for politicians. Trust. So we've got to try and build up the respect for politicians. In the same way, banks have got to build up the respect about themselves.
Right. So it's about back down to leadership again.
Back to leadership, yes.
Back down to kind of getting the values right, back down to having more women on boards.
Boards, yes.
Women in leadership positions. In the final area, it's kind of back onto the area that you've really been focused on. It's about empowerment of women that, you know, a lot of your life's just been focused on. The bit that I'd like to ask you about, because it seems to me a particularly dark side of human nature just now, and you mentioned it earlier, displaced people, the whole issue of human trafficking, which and enslaving of women, is particularly abhorrent, but it seems to be there. It doesn't seem to be going away.
It's not getting any better.
How as human beings on earth do we allow that to happen?
You know that women are the middle management in this business.
Really?
It's been proved that women are middle management because women trust women.
Right.
And in some cases, it's women who have sold off their daughters. And in certain camps, they can't wait to get the daughters married because that's another one that they're not responsible for. The husband talks it over with the woman. And in the same way, they sell their children.
So basically, you're coming down to then it's poverty?
It's poverty.
At the bottom line?
Poverty is the bottom line. And people think, well, if I give the children away, or if the children went off to another country, if I got them to X, they would then be able to make a life. I could get there, or they could send money home.
All right.
If you think of our families, you come from Scotland, my parents came from Ireland. If you think how they went off and the whole thing, or like the Filipinos working here, yeah. it's sending the money home, improving the GDP of the family and the country.
Yeah.
The Philippines figure for money going back and to Nepal is enormous.
Enormous, I know that. So they basically have nothing.
They have
just
nothing.
Work all the time, and it's for their family.
It's for their families. They work 24/7.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some of them who are here have got trouble with their papers, so they're all going to the Middle East. Yeah. And they're encouraging their daughters and sons trained to be nurses so they can work. Terrible, that'd be far worse than here.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, so...
So the commodity is...
We can understand where the demand's coming from, the poverty. But then on the other hand, the other side of this, there's gangs working on it and then people are using them. So, I mean, that side of it's appalling.
That's why you want women on boards, so that they will be looking at... Now, in Britain, we have had the bill about the supply chain. So the companies have to have a kite mark to yeah. where they are.
Yeah.
Now, a Spanish company, I can't remember its name, but one of my friends is on the board there, which takes in Zara and the others. And I said to Nala, I need to talk to you about this. She said, I know what you're going to talk to me about. This is what we're doing. She's straight up, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But and companies have to do that. But right. more and more companies and more and more countries around the world should do that, because that would help to stop human trafficking yeah. and bonded labour. And for supermarkets now to have a mark to where the flowers are coming from,
yeah.
where is the fish coming from?
Yeah.
Is it guys who are not on the ship for X years without being able to come off?
Yeah,
you know, because
yeah.
remember, a person who's been trafficked or is trafficked never has a long life.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And these nail bars around the world have to be watched too, because they're in every city. And when they say cash only, you know well what's there.
Yeah, so there's a whole issue about kind of that kind of black economy.
The black economy has to be sorted out as well.
But the black economy, again, you know, from my experience of working in different kind of cities, is again sort of driven by poverty. Why are people in the black economy?
Because they need the cash.
They need the cash because they can't get out of the situation.
It was like a woman who now is no longer Uber, who myself and other women had a row with at a KPMG breakfast, when we were asked, why haven't you got enough women working in the Uber business in London? So she said, well, women only work for cash. And pretty much, she said, women do not work for cash. I mean, there was an almighty row, but there is this thing that's seen that women are working still. And this was by a woman of 40 who should have known better. Yeah. University educated and everything else. But she still thought we were just working for pin money. Yeah. Not her, though. You see, so women at the same, so you have to understand that in this.
Yeah.
And I was shattered that day because I had not expected to hear it from somebody like that. But it's good because it woke me up again. You know.
Yeah.
But we have to remember that women, in some respects, are women's own enemies too.
Yeah.
But that doesn't just, we have to change that. And we change it by just telling them. But
So there's women in the systems, but the system's there because of the overall economic system
yes.
in the first place.
If but women should be there.
If we can somehow create this new system, basically we would be saying we do away with the black economy.
We have to do away with
black because there would be no demand. You do away with trafficking because there'd be no demand.
That's right.
And
the goods would be made properly.
Yes. And so you're coming back down to the same issue that which we originally started talking.
Yes.
You know, half an hour or so ago, which was about where are we buying the goods from? What about microfinance? What about fair trade, etc.
Fair trade is vital.
These sorts of concepts have to come into play if we're going to tackle the issues that you've spent your life.
Why do you think if you go to Primark and you can buy a T-shirt for £2, does that person get paid?
Yeah.
I remember it's got to be packaged beautifully.
So it'll be about 5p.
Precisely.
I would reckon by the time you've taken off all the 100% markup for the retailers, £1, less your distribution costs, less your marketing.
That shows you why we have to get rid of this black economy
Absolutely.
Fair trade.
Absolutely. But you can understand
why
people...
We have to get away from fair trade coffee. That's okay. But that's not dealing with the real issues.
Well, you see the
thing... You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's important. It raises it.
Well, what I think... No, you're absolutely I totally agree with you. The issue is... that the fair trade's right and your fair trade coffee is right, but it only goes so far.
That's right. It doesn't take the whole... It started it.
So the people that have started this and are involved in it, it's great that they're doing this. This is really positive and they should be supported. But actually what we need to do is to do a lot more. So if you speak to the coffee producers, which I have done in Bolivia and some Latin American countries, they'll tell you about how actually they're still... It's a very small percentage... that they're getting of the whole, if you imagine, from the coffee bean to our supermarket. And that's a really interesting discussion to have. But it's those discussions we need to have and build into this new economy, I believe.
That's what has to change.
But rather than kind of saying, oh, no, that doesn't really work, I think there's a lot of discussion, for example, about impact investing now.
Oh, yes.
And it's quite controversial.
I've got a friend who does a lot of this social impact investing.
Social impact. So,
and doing these projects around it.
Yeah, so some people... think this is great. Other people I know, particularly in Scotland, really against it. Don't like it.
They're fearful of it as well.
Very fearful of it. Doesn't think it's fair, and it's just about people making money out of poverty, etc. But my mind is no. It's people who've come in with a concept to start something. Is it perfect? No. But hey, let's try and build on that. Let's try and make it better. And that's how you'll end up in a better place.
Absolutely.
So we have to support the people out there.
We have to support out there.
Doing stuff.
But we want to make it more.
We want to make it better. More,
make it much better.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, this has been fabulous talking to you.
And if you want to edit and talk to me, let me know. That's
fine. I think I can speak to you for another couple of hours. I'm sure you've got lots
yes,
to say.
Lots of,
but, you know, it's been great. And in particular, I do so strongly agree with you, the role of women in leadership position in this kind of new economy is absolutely critical and vital. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was fascinating to hear Mary's views on the benefits of the fairer distribution of wealth and of having more women in positions of power. We'd love to hear your thoughts via Twitter at newismtalks or via our website newismtalks.com. Next week, we'll be talking to Lawrence DeMarco, an expert in community development and local empowerment. We hope to see you there.